Blog Talk Radio.
UR Tennis is an advocacy group for underrepresented tennis participants. These participants would include players, parents, coaches, and the learners of all racial minorities, all social class minorities, all sexual minorities, all age-related minorities, and anyone who seems to have been forgotten. Our mission is to act as the voice for tennis. We are striving to bring forth programs, contests, issues, news, education, and philanthropy that will benefit all in tennis. We are seeking active participation from populations that believe they have an interest in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We want to expand our outreach royally, regionally, nationally, and worldly. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to continuously be talked about, and we will pursue this idea relentlessly.
Welcome to the Parenting Nations radio show on the UR Tennis Network of Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and I am so glad that you are here joining us today. We have a great show ahead. Our guest today is Dr. Larry Lauer, and I'll give you a little bit of background on Larry in just a few minutes. But before we jump into that, I just want to remind those of you with tennis-playing kids that USTA is holding a series of listening meetings around the country right now to discuss the proposed changes to the junior competition schedule. And if you are not up to speed on what's going on that front, please check out parentingaces.com for updates and meeting dates and locations. And if you have any questions on it, you can always contact me through the website. If you click on the About Lisa Stone tab, you'll see all my contact information. I welcome your questions. I welcome your comments. And together, I hope that all of us can effect some good changes here with regards to our kids and their ability to continue to develop as players. So, okay, that's the end of my little political statement. Log on to the website for more. There's lots on there. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest today. Dr. Larry Lauer, who we are just so lucky to have with us today, is the Director of Coaching Education and Development in the Institute for the Study of Youth Sports at Michigan State University. He's also an assistant coach for MSU's men's tennis team. He has a PhD in exercise and sports science, sports psychology, and is the founder of the Championship Performance Consulting Company. He's the sports psychology consultant to the USA Hockey National Team Development Program, and he provides mental performance consults with athletes, teams, coaches, from youth to professional levels of sports, hockey included, but also tennis. He's the first editor of the USTA Mental Skills and Drills book and has written a bunch of articles in many popular magazines. He was also a correspondent to NHL.com, writing mental toughness articles during the 2008 National Hockey League playoffs. He works with the U.S. Olympic Committee. He works with several different high school and community associations, and we're really lucky to have him today to talk with us. Before I bring Larry on the line, I want to just give out our guest call-in number. It is 714-583-6853. Again, 714-583-6853 if you have any comments or questions for Larry during the show. And before I bring Larry on air, I'm going to go ahead and play a quick commercial from one of our sponsors. After the commercial, we'll be right back with Dr. Larry Lauer.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to Parenting Aces. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and I'm so thrilled to welcome our guest today, Dr. Larry Lauer, Director of Coaching Education and Development at Michigan State University. Larry, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Lisa, for having me on. I appreciate it.
So before we jump in here, why don't you give us a little bit of information? What does it mean to be the Director of Coaching Education and Development?
Well, my role here at Michigan State is to really work with our research part of what we do in terms of studying the benefits and detriments of youth sport on a participant, and then turn that back into information that people in the community can use. So, for example, we've done a series of research projects looking at tennis parents and how the role that they play throughout their child's development in tennis, and then we turn that around into online workshops, into face-to-face workshops, articles, presentations, many different ways that we can get the information back out to those people who need it, parents, coaches, athletes. So a big part of what I do here at MSU is to take our research, turn it back into information that the public can use, and then also talking to the public a lot in terms of what are the kinds of questions you need answered, what are some of the things that would help you better coach, parent, be an athlete, administer programs, and that's a big part of what we do here at the Institute. So I would say that's my main role. I have a number of different roles here, but the main one is to do research and turn that back into products that help the public do what they want to do.
So are we tennis parents really as bad as everybody says we are?
Well, that's a question that we don't have a straight answer for. I get that question a lot, actually. Is it getting worse? Are parents just worse today? The other question I get is tennis worse than hockey? Is tennis worse than baseball? My answer to that is, I don't know, to be honest. What I would say is that we know that parents are more involved in their children's lives more than ever, and really take this time period of childhood seriously in terms of developing their child so that they have skills and abilities that they can use later on in life, whether it's academic, social, athletic. And so childhood's really become a time period of developing young people later in life. I remember when I was growing up, my parents certainly tried to develop me, but you know, when I had a basketball game, you know, they just kind of let me go and do my thing. There wasn't too much involvement. If they needed to drive, they drove. My dad did coach me for a while in baseball, but, you know, they kind of left it at that, and a lot of what I did was in the backyard. So I think what we're finding now is that parents are more involved in their child's sports, specifically tennis, and when you get parents more involved, the percentage of problems are probably going to go up too, right? And so I think it's natural. Why are parents more involved? Again, they want to make sure their child's successful, have some skills that they can use later in life, maybe to get that scholarship. But one of the other things we're learning about parents is that they're basing their self-worth on their child's success. And so when you do that, you're definitely going to be involved and make sure that your child is successful.
So that begs the question then, your statement that parents are basing their self-worth on their child's success. I mean, when you say it like that, it sounds like a really negative thing. And I think most of us who, at least the ones who are tuning into Parenting Aces, are committed to being the best tennis parent that we can be. And we try really hard not to link our self-worth to our kids' performance. We've read, we've educated ourselves, we've attended lectures. We know that that's probably not a good thing for our kid. So, you know, it becomes kind of a conundrum, because if we are that involved, and I'll say, you know, I'm as guilty as anybody, you know, I don't want my kid to lose. I don't want my kid to put forth a half effort when he's on the court. Does it make me feel like I'm a lesser person when that happens? Sometimes it does. I have to be honest. And it's very difficult to separate myself from that. And, I think there's a big difference in feeling that way and then expressing that we feel that way. Would you agree with that statement?
I would definitely agree with that, Lisa. I think as a parent, you don't really want to separate totally. I think that investment you have emotionally in your child is healthy in some ways, for sure. The other part of that is knowing the line where not to cross. Knowing that the decision for tennis has to be your child's decision, that if they want to quit, that they can quit, when they've fulfilled their commitment. And again, there's a lot of gray area there. But I do think when the parent starts to wrap up their own sort of motives and feelings into why they participate or how certain things are being decided, then you run into real problems. I remember when I was at UNC Greensboro I moved here to Michigan State, we did a study of 10 professional tennis players, one of their parents who was most involved in their development, and then one of their junior coaches to look at their development over time. And it was quite enlightening. But one of the anecdotes was a player who said, I remember telling my mom that I didn't want to play tennis anymore. And her response was she got angry and said, how could you do this to me? And that sort of, when you tear away all the other layers, that's what it gets down to. Who's this about? Whose goals? Why are we doing this? And if you're, as a parent, making decisions based on your self-worth, then I think you're crossing the line. I think you always got to do it based on your child's interest and what's best for them. Is it easy to cross the line? Absolutely. And when children mess up, does it affect us as it should? Yeah, it should. But I think that there's a fine line between being invested and being over-involved. And, we don't know all the gray in that, but for sure, when it becomes about you in the decision-making process, then you've crossed the line.
Well, it's interesting. I've read that study that you did at UNC Greensboro. It's fascinating. And for those of you listening to the show, if you haven't read it, pretty sure it's published on USTA's website, and I think I may even have a link to it on parentingaces.com. If I don't, I'll add one on our links page because it's fascinating reading. But so, as a result of that research you did, I don't remember the details of the study. Were there definitive positive and negative outcomes that you could identify based on parental involvement?
Yeah, and again, we're talking about a small number of people, and we're more interested in case studies about development. But we did. We tended to look at things. We try to categorize the experience, the feel of the development over time, and we broke it down into three categories. And one was a very positive sort of development where the parents were supportive, were involved, but weren't controlling, weren't overly critical, weren't pushing too hard. And again, there's some gray in this, but they were going it sort of by what you would say is the textbook way for the most part. And what we found is that, their children were successful. Again, we're talking about all professional tennis players here. Their children were successful, and they had a good relationship with their parents at the end of the day throughout this long process of developing tennis talent. We had this difficult transition group where things, they started out okay when the kids were young, but then there was a lot of pressure as they got to 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, controlling issues, maybe being too critical. But then those parents tended to sort of figure it out later on, maybe when the kid was 17, 18, an older junior, or when they went off to play pro. And they were able to still keep that good relationship with their child, even though they had a rocky sort of developmental time period, which in some ways is very normal. And then there was this very, what we called almost a tumultuous development, where there was a lot of pressure, a lot of criticism, a lot of push, was sometimes out to support. And in those situations, those athletes, they made the pro tour. However, it was with a lot of baggage. They didn't have a good relationship, at least with the parent that was highly involved in their tennis. And what we tended to find, again, we're talking about very small numbers, those people didn't last as long on the pro tour as the people who had a better relationship with their parents. So it really comes down to, I remember one player talking about how, you know, his parents were involved in a very positive way throughout his development. And then they'd come to tournaments and they'd look nervous. And he told them to stay home. He's like, if you're going to look nervous, just stay home. And the point I make to parents is that if you're going to invest all this time, money, emotional support for however many years you're doing this, 12, 13, 14, and then when they get to the point where, you know, you were kind of dreaming of, they're playing Division I tennis or they're playing on the Pro Tour, and then they tell you to stay home, that kind of hits home, right? Like, oh, you know, maybe it wasn't worth it. Because now mm-hmm. when you sort of get to the end of the spectrum, they don't want you involved anymore. And so we have to think about, you know, there are some definite, in terms of our research with those 10 people, differences between when they had a positive experience, when they had a tumultuous one, and what ended up with that relationship with a parent.
Well, and the message I'm taking away from what you just said is, even if you go through a tumultuous period at some point in the development process, there is a way to rescue yourself and your relationship with
Absolutely.
Your child from that. So, I mean, that's a positive. It's not that we parents have to be perfect all the time, that we have to be the ideal, you know, calm and easygoing. Oh, honey, you don't feel like practicing today. Okay, that's fine. We don't have to be like that all the time in order to salvage our relationship with our child, which, I mean, yes. For me, honestly, that's a huge thing to hear. And, you know, it's inevitable for me that I'm going to screw up. I screw up more often than not. And I watch myself screw up and I tell myself to stop, but, yeah. You know, that internal mama bear personality just comes out in full force, and sometimes it gets beyond my control. So I'm relieved to hear that I'm not permanently messing up here.
Yeah, no, you're not. And if anyone says they're a perfect parent, then they probably need to go to therapy. Because absolutely, there's no perfect parent, as there's no perfect coach or no perfect athlete. And that's what I tell the parents when I meet with them, because I do a lot of parenting workshops. I also do a lot of workshops with coaches, and I'll tell them, look, if you're asking for the perfect parent, then you're asking for something that's unrealistic. People are going to make mistakes. We all make mistakes. I make mistakes with my children, and they're 5 and under, and I'm still trying to figure that out. So parenting is the hardest thing you ever do and the most rewarding. And so when you throw tennis in here, when your child's out there by him or herself, where everybody knows the score, when winning and losing is public, that's a lot for a parent and an athlete to handle. So it's no surprise to me that people would have struggles with this. So my wife and I joke about, with all the research I've done in parenting and the workshops, that I'm either going to be the best parent or the worst. We're not quite sure, you know, sports parents. So it's a matter of really, like you said, checking yourself, paying attention to how you're making decisions, how you're interacting with your daughter or your son, really being self-aware and talking to your child about these things, especially as they get older, become a teenager. Talk to them about their experiences and their experiences with you being involved. How am I, you know, during the match? Is it helping you? Is it hurting you? What are your thoughts on that? Or when do you like it when I do this? And again, you don't want to do it in a naggy way, but when it's relaxed and you're at dinner, you know, or you're just sitting around chatting, throw some of these questions in now and again, just to help you understand the influence you're having on your child. And there's no perfect parent. And the other point I wanted to make, Lisa, that you were saying, is that when we talked about the positive parents, I want to make sure that the listeners hear this correctly. It wasn't that it was everything was hugs, high fives, and there was no pushing. Those parents push too. There's a part of this that if you want to develop talent in anything, that the parents need to push you to some extent. What does that look like? Well, for example, one is if you make a commitment to play tennis, that you follow through on that commitment. So you need to get up on that Saturday morning practice or when your friends are going to do something else, and you decided, and that's the key, that the child was a part of the decision or made a decision that you wanted to play tennis, you have to follow through on your commitment because your coach is counting on you. If it's a group lesson, those other kids are counting on you. You need to count on yourself to be there. So there's a big part of this where the parents who are positive still pushed and on the right things at the right times. They didn't do it right after matches, and they would more likely push their child and challenge their child when it came to character or life things versus performance. You know, they would really push them to give a great effort, and they wouldn't focus so much on the outcome. And I think that's the lesson here, is that we do, as parents, we do need to challenge our children as we support them, but at the same time, it's got to be at the right time on the right things, because when it gets messed up, it can really get messed up. You know, and that's some of the cases I talked about before, and a tumultuous part of it is the parents really never were able to sort of remove themselves from the process as the kid got older, and it still was focused on performance, and there was still criticism. And I'll tell you, and I don't want to ramble on too much, I'm going to stop with this point. The number one, in my mind, in years of researching this and working with athletes, the number one biggest mistake that a parent can make is to make their love conditional. The number one mistake. If you can keep your love unconditional, then you can pull yourselves out of those tumultuous situations, which you're going to have some when you're talking about teenagers.
Sure. That's a very, very important point. I want to just take a moment to give our call-in number out because you're saying so much good stuff. And
thank you.
I'm hoping that people listening, you know, are that this is resonating with them. Our call-in number, if you'd care to call in and chat with Larry or me, is 714-583-6853. Again, 714-583-6853. So, Larry, you mentioned something about when kids want to quit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to touch on that because, of course, you know, my kid's 16. We've gone through that a couple times over the years, and it's always a really stressful time in our house. And the older he gets, the more stressful it becomes when he kind of reaches the boiling point, because we all have, I mean, as other families out there have as well, invested so much in his tennis. He's invested his time. He's made sacrifices, you know, over the years that have varying levels of intensity to them. We've sacrificed family-wise. We've sacrificed financially, time-wise. And so you said that as long as a child has fulfilled their commitment, then I think I'm saying this correctly, that it's that a parent has to let them make that decision. Am I stating your position correctly?
Yeah, I think so. This is one of the hardest topics to sort of wrap your arms around, because I think people are going to be in all different places on this. I think in terms of if you look at the long-term outcome of the parent-child relationship, the thing that you want to do is give your child choice. Now, when they're 7, choice is going to be, you know, wearing this outfit or this outfit, or choosing from these 3 things on the menu. Choices change over time, and you want them to become better decision makers and more independent little people. So, you know, that's a part of you want to be giving choice. You want to be communicating. When as parents we control everything, it becomes a real issue. Now, getting to your question about, you know, quitting, I think it comes down to very good communication from the start. So when you're talking to your child, again, this is all age-related, and let's say they're a teenager and you say, well, okay, if we're going to do this tennis thing again this year, and I'm not quite sure when that is because tennis seems to go year-round and just overlap now. But
There's no season.
It's just an ongoing thing. But you pick one, right? And so, but you would sit down and talk to your child about, you know, what it is that they want to do and what the expectations are and what the sacrifices are. I think an informed young person can make an informed decision. I think the mistake we often make is we say, well, we try to do this right. We say, well, you know, do you want to do tennis again? We're committing to do another 12 months. Yeah, let's do it. Without thinking about all the sacrifices, all of the investment, which can be monetary, time, emotional, friendships, without really going through those. Part of why we avoid that is we're scared as parents to give our child a real out. And that's to say, here's what it is, and we present all the information. We're afraid they're going to say, you know what, I'm going to exit stage right, I'm going to go do something else, which is scary, right, because you have invested a lot of time, money, effort into tennis. But the reason why it's important is, again, in my practice as a sports psychology consultant, I work with a lot of junior tennis players. And the ones that I have the least amount of success with, because they often come in with confidence issues or anxiety or some of these other issues, are the ones who feel like they're playing for their parents. And in particular, there's this one junior tennis player. He and I worked together for quite a long time, had some success, but really not to the level the coach and I thought we could have. And he was pushing towards a D1 scholarship for tennis, and eventually he just kind of dropped off. He stopped coming to practice. He stopped meeting with me. It just, you know, sort of ended. I run into him, I don't know, a year or so later, and he's walking onto a college team. And I was like, wow, you know, you're going to play tennis again? He's like, yeah. And we talked, and he said, you know, the thing I had to do, because I always played for my parents, was to actually make the decision to quit. And then when I came back to tennis, it was my decision, and so now I can enjoy it again. And there's a lot less pressure, a lot more enjoyment, and I think I'll be a lot more successful. So I think, you know, and I've seen this kind of play itself out numerous times, that if we don't give our child a real out, that we're still controlling the situation and not really, you know, letting them sort of choose their path. And I think, you know, we owe it to our children eventually to really help them understand how to make good decisions and choose their path in life. Quitting is a tough issue. I think, you know, again, on the other side of this, you make a commitment if the expectations are clear from the front end and they're discussed and the child isn't coerced into saying yes or not given all the information and they want to do it, then they need to fulfill that commitment. You know, obviously there's circumstances where you may not make them do it if they're injured or they're sick or, you know, something with the coach. But for the most part, you know, that's a life lesson, too. When you commit to something, you see it through, then we'll revisit this when you're done. Again, that's something that I learned from one of the parents from our study was they'd sit down every year with their young tennis player and ask him, you know, we want to continue to do this again this year and kind of walk through what it was going to take. And he kept saying yes. And so they kept doing it. And it's a scary proposition, but I think it's something that at least that child then still owns their tennis versus feeling like they're playing for you.
Well, it's interesting. I think I've shared this story before on the show or through the blog, but when my son, who's now 16, was, how old was he? He was 13, I guess. He had a meltdown. And decided he wanted to quit. And this went on really just for a full day. I mean, it wasn't a huge period of time. But, I mean, he was in agony over this and, you know, feeling like he had had enough and really wanted to quit. And I kept talking with him. I was emailing his coach saying, oh, my God, you know, what do we do here? And at the end of the day, he had time to kind of think through things and come to the conclusion that he really didn't want to quit. He really did want to keep playing. He was just having some anxiety about a couple of specific issues that were going on. But he said to me, Mom, I need to know I can count on you not to let me quit even when I tell you I want to.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know I can count on you not to let me. Well, I've hung on to that. I mean, that was a pretty powerful statement to hear from my, frankly, relatively immature 13-year-old son at that point. And it's something that's really kind of stuck with me. And now that he's older and the stakes are higher and the sacrifices are greater, I'm wondering, does that statement still apply? Do I need to let that go? Or do I hold on to that and remind him of that?
Well, I think that speaks to the communication you have with your son, which is great, that he would confide in you in that way. I mean, 13-year-old boys don't normally confide in that way with their parents, I don't think. So I think that's great. It speaks to, again, the communication you're having with your son. You know, your question is a great one. I think, you know, understanding the why the person wants to quit is very important. And this other point I wanted to make is that all players think of quitting, even professional players have these thoughts at times. And so they're not unusual and we don't have to panic. I think we need to understand, we've got to break through the layers and understand the core reason of why they want to quit. And if there is something serious there, then we have to consider it. But usually kids will work through things and if given some time, or, you know, if they have a passion for something, they'll come back to it. The point of should you hold on to this idea that don't let me quit, I think you should at least bring it up in conversation again in a very relaxed sort of setting where it's like, hey, you know, I remember you bringing this up and, you know, how do you feel like I've been doing with that? Have I been supportive? Have you felt like quitting at times? Or, you know, you may just bring it up in conversation in a relaxed way just to see where your son is on that again. You know, it'd be real interesting to know what his thoughts were on that same sort of idea. When you said he's 16 now or 17?
16, yeah.
16, just to see where he's at, you know. And again, I would do it not after a loss. I would do it at the right time, like when you've had a break, you know, from tennis or things are going well, you know. So timing is everything with these things, but and the way you do it is also very important. But I would ask, to be honest. If you don't know what he's thinking, ask him. You know, he may really say that that's helpful, and you know, he needs to continue to just think in that way, and he may say, you know what, I don't need that anymore. I'm 16 now, and I know what I need to do, and I'm good to go. You know, so it'd be real interesting to know what he thinks.
It would be. I'm a little scared to ask, frankly. and as good a communicator as he was at 13. The teen years have definitely taken hold at 16, and yep. The communication is less thorough now. But, you know, I think that your underlying message is that keeping that line of communication open is huge, and, you know, mm-hmm. fostering that from the parental side is huge. I think it anybody listening who has teenagers now or who has parented teenagers understands what an enormous challenge it is to keep them talking, especially the boys. The girls, I think, tend to be a little bit more forthcoming. At least that was my experience with my daughters. But the boys are, you know, they're different. They definitely are different, and it is a challenge from time to time. So.
Yeah,
wow.
And I think we, as a parent, we have to really put forethought into this issue and plan on how we want to continue to keep that conversation open. I mean, I think it's important to, again, the timing of when you're asking, but asking questions and listening about things that are important to them. You know, one of the things that our tennis parents study told us was that, and I didn't expect this, to be honest, that one of the biggest mistakes that parents made was not necessarily being critical, but constantly talking about tennis. And it just created a perception of importance to the child. And so while the parent may not be saying, you know, you need to win this match or we paid money, so let's start playing better, it was just sort of the nonstop or conversation about tennis. And so I think being, again, one point you made earlier, Lisa, is that checking yourself, being self-aware, am I focusing too much on one part of their lives? Am I, you know, sort of going down the wrong road with this, knowing that you're going to make mistakes, and when you do, admit to it and tell them you're sorry. You know, maybe run suicides on the court when you make mistakes. You know, that would make them happy. But you do what you can to sort of show them that they can trust you and you're there when they need it. And that's the biggest thing, right, is that they communicate when they need you the most. They're not going to communicate as much with you, unfortunately, usually when they're a teenager. But as long as they're communicating on the important things, you know, you keep that line open. So.
Yeah, it is huge. It is huge, and I swear I feel like you have been living in my house for the last few weeks. We've had a lot of these conversations, namely that I do tend to talk tennis too much, and, you know, my involvement with this show and with my blog. I mean, tennis is an enormous part of my life alone and also my life with my kids, so... it does take a very conscious effort for me to find other things to talk about when we're together. And sure. My son has told me, he has said to me, you know, when I'm home, I really don't want to talk about my tennis. I spend enough time thinking about it and talking about it with my coach and with my tennis friends. And, you know, home needs to be different. It needs to be turned off at home. So I was very glad that he said that to me.
That's good. Well, it sounds like you have those lines open, but I think if we think about it from the athletic standpoint, and I think the longer that we're adults and we're not competing, we forget this. It's when you are competing as a tennis player, it's physically, psychologically, emotionally taxing. There's no, especially as you get older, taxing. It takes a lot of your energy. And home is one of those safe places where you can kind of just let your guard down and be yourself and regenerate and recover. And so when parents focus on the sport too much, it takes away that safe place to recover. That allows them to build back up that psychological and emotional energy. And I see this a lot in the athletes I work with because I work with a lot of adolescents and their parents and coaches. Now, at the same time, you know, I think from the tennis standpoint, it's hard for the parents because they're not there. They're working. Maybe the tennis player goes off to the tournament and plays, and you want to know what's going on. You want to be involved. You want to show you care and are supportive. It's finding the fine line of how much you can talk about it, and then purposely bringing other things, talking about their friends or what's going on at school or if they're homeschooled, then, you know, that's another issue. But, you know, in terms of how much time they're spending with you. But, you know, so anything you can do, and it's something that was brought up earlier, that when you are parenting your child, you want to create this way of them identifying, where they identify themselves in many different ways, as a student, as an athlete, as a brother or sister, a son or daughter, as a musician. If they have these different things that they identify with, then when one goes bad, they still have a lot going for them. But let's say you totally identify with being a tennis player, and that's all your parents talk about, and then you hit a major slump, you're not winning, you're thinking about quitting, what do you have then? Your total identity was wrapped up in being a tennis player. That's who you are at school. That's who you are at home. That's who you are at tennis. Obviously, you don't have any other sort of identity. And when you do that and that gets taken away or that's not going well, then you run into some, I think you can run into some psychological problems with that. You know, we hear athletes, pro athletes, talking about being depressed after their sport ends, especially when it's due to injury or they get cut, you know, where they haven't been able to finish on top. So, you know, that's one of the things that we're trying to do as a parent is help our child identify with multiple things that are they're passionate about, that are important to them, so that when one does go bad and one doesn't, maybe they don't reach their dream in that area, they got other things to be proud of and to, you know, really pursue.
Well, I agree with you, and I will say that at least where we are, if you are trying to reach the top level tennis-wise, tennis is all-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. It's the way it is around here, and I'm guessing others can relate to that too. So, again, as the child becomes older, when they're little, it's easy to help them diversify and have some different interests. But as they get older, and in my son's case, he's a sophomore in high school, so, you know, the college thing is looming on the horizon and, you know, thinking about all of that. It becomes very difficult to carve out blocks of time to devote to something other than school and tennis. They're homeschooled, it's a different issue. But for the kids who are going to traditional school, high school has become way more difficult than it was when I was in school. The amount of time required for homework and for projects and, you know, all of that has increased, you know, just enormously. So that, as a parent, again, you know, I'm listening to you talk about this and I'm thinking, oh, my God, how do we do that? Like, how do we make that happen? And, you know, I'm not sure what the answer is. I mean, you know, my son used to play soccer and baseball and he played drums and he took piano lessons and now it's tennis and school and tennis and school. And that's it. That's really it.
Yeah, you know, and that seems to be the way that we've structured the environment of sport in this country and in school, where you really you kind of put all your eggs in that basket and you go for it. We're studying sports specialization here and year-round training to understand it better. I feel your pain because I know the pain's probably coming for me too. Because you're right, you're in a dilemma. There's not a clear answer. Because of the way the sport's structured in this country, if you want to reach an elite level, then you're going to have to do certain things and make a lot of sacrifices. That's a decision that has to be made. And when the child makes that decision, I want this and I'm willing to make these sacrifices, that makes it a lot easier. Now, you don't want to do that too early, but that does make that a lot easier. I would say, though, as a parent, you do your best to try to work in other things, whether you're communicating, you know, in the car and talking about different stuff. Or I remember one in our tennis study again, one of the parents talking about when they went on a trip for a tennis tournament, they would go see a local university, go see it to a museum. So they would work in a way to diversify when they're on these trips, to bring in other things, educational or just fun or family things. So I think that's very important. I think where the other part of this concern is that when you become an elite tennis player, everyone around you, their lives are focused on helping the elite tennis player be prepared to play the next match. And so on these trips, and I work with juniors and college players and pro players, so I understand everything you're basing on, your schedule, the activities, are all based on that person having good energy when they start their next match. Mm-hmm. And so these ideas about going to a museum or going to the amusement park are hard to pull off when you're thinking, well, you know, I don't really want them, you know, being out in the sun when they got to play they got two matches tomorrow at least. You know, so those are the tough decisions, and I understand, you know, that parents get stuck. it's really hard to make a decision. You know, as sports psychology professionals, we're telling you, you know, you need to give your time, you know, your child time, prepare for matches, to recover, to do all the things they need to do to be mentally ready. But at the same time, having a break from tennis can sometimes be the best thing that a person does to play good tennis, to help keep things normal. So there is no formula. There's no recipe. We're trying to understand it better here at our institute so we can give better advice to parents. I think the key thing is, again, does a child want this? Do they make an informed decision about it? And then trying to still work in ways to do different things as best as you can. Are you going to do it like when they were six, where they're involved in six different things? And no, absolutely not. Probably at best, especially if you're an elite athlete that might be involved in sport, academics, and maybe one other thing, you know, when they get to be 16, 17, 18, and probably by the time they're 18, 17, that might fall away too, you know, that other activity. So it's sort of the nature of the beast, to be honest.
And so through the research that you guys are doing at the Institute, are you finding that this new culture of early specialization is a good thing? I mean, I can't imagine it is. I mean, from a performance standpoint, I would say probably yes. You know, we look at other cultures and where they pull the kids at a very young age and, you know, everything they do is focused on that one area, whether it's a sport or an art or academics. But that's not traditionally been the way we've done things in this country. But in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, it seems that's where we've headed. And, I'm just not sure we're doing anybody any favors.
Well, I think we need to be careful with it because, you know, I have a bunch of thoughts running through my head. But one is it's more of a deselection model. And I mean that when you bring in these kids in this setting and you bring these what you think are talented athletes in and then you work them 24/7, 365, usually you're not trying to grow the numbers of the game. You're trying to find the next Roger Federer, Andy Roddick, Rafael Nadal, right? I mean,
right.
Or Serena Williams, or whomever you want to talk about. That's your goal. You're in the business of finding a champion. That's what you're trying to do, or develop the champion. And so, you know, we have to be careful with that. The other thing is, we've heard a lot now about this idea that it takes 10,000 hours or 10 years to develop expertise, or this idea that with deliberate hard work, you can become an expert in tennis. Which, you know, in many cases is true. I mean, the problem is when you're 5 and you start your 10-year process, when you're 15, you put in all these hours, and a lot of these kids are burned out at that point.
Right.
They don't want to do it anymore. This deliberate practice, you talk about it, it's not that fun. You know, hitting forehand after forehand after forehand as your coach is drilling you is not – I mean, I love tennis. You know, and I like to mix. I do like to do other things. You know, it gives me a break from it, or even on the court, you know, playing games and stuff like that, just to mix it up. But so I think, you know, we have to be careful that when we get started in this talent development process, that, you know, if we're trying to get our 10 years in right away, you may not like what you see at the end of the 10 years. You're going to have an athlete saying, okay, see you later. I've done it. I'm done with that. I want to try something different, which is kind of human nature to do different things. Now, what I also say is one of the big issues that parents have to understand is that kids who are champions at 10 and under or 12 and under are not normally champions at 18 and under. And if you go back and look at it, it just there's not a real good correlation there. And I was talking to a junior tennis player I work with, and we said, okay, let's take a look at the top 20 in Texas from a certain year for 12 and under. We looked at the list. We were like, all right, let's now in a separate window, let's pull up the top 20 for that same year, birth year, at 16 and under. And there was only two players in both lists, two
wow.
out of 20. Just in Texas. We're not talking about nationally. We're talking in Texas, the top 20, which is a very competitive state. But so the point being that why get so hung up on, you know, putting all your marbles in this basket right now? When it's going to be important is when you're 17, 18, when you're physically maturing, and now you can put everything together and become that elite athlete that you're hoping to be. If we get too hung up on winning at age 12 or hiding certain strokes or not playing against certain competition, local kids because of our ranking or whatever, we're missing the greater point of the immediate results don't matter so much as do the long-term results. Now, I get the point that you need to win certain things, tournaments, to be able to get into other tournaments, just how it works. But at the end of the day, the focus needs to be on being great at 18, not at 12. And so keep it light, keep it fun. Losses are a learning experience when you're young, as they are when you're older too. And try to keep it, you know, different things, different activities in there. The National Association of Sport and Physical Education is recommending that kids do not specialize in one sport before age 15. They feel that there's crossover effects, so playing other sports benefits your development, plus for all the psychological reasons we talked about. So is that hard number the same for everyone? No. If you're a gymnast, specializing at 15 is probably too late. But in tennis, I think we've seen that, you know, if we do it too early, we get some really weird effects on the back end of it.
Well, the issue we face in tennis is the way our competitive structure is set up in this country. And it's under attack right now, and we may see some changes coming about. I hope we see some positive changes coming about. But the way it's set up now, if you want to develop into a player that is sought after as at the collegiate level, you know, there's certain hoops you have to jump through, and you know, the way that the tournament structure is set up, you can't get into this tournament unless you've played X number of lower level tournaments to earn the ranking points that allow you in, and you know, so it's very tough for kids who want to take a break or who want to try another sport to stay at the upper end of tennis by doing that. And I'm not sure that it's possible, frankly, given our current structure. But I do see a lot of burnout. And again, you know, especially since my son is 16 now, he's actually playing 18s because of a summer birthday. There are a lot of kids who are gone that were around in the 12s and 14s who are, they're gone now. They don't play anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's, to me, it's really sad. And it happened to me. I mean, I played through my freshman year of high school and then quit for 30 something years. So, you know, I've seen it personally in myself and in my son's peers. The burnout issue is big, and you know, your point of putting in that 10,000 hours only at the end of it to say, okay, I got there and I'm miserable and now I'm moving on to something else,
right?
Could be devastating. I mean, as a parent, I can't imagine. I honestly can't imagine, you know, how you would manage that. It would be very difficult.
Yeah, you know, that's where if the parents out there, they got younger kids, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and they're thinking about this, you know, what's it worth it to you? I mean, for me, looking at all the research, talking to all these parents, coaches, and athletes, keep it light and loose for as long as you can, even, you know, getting coaches who have fun but still develop talent, because if you can give me an athlete who has a good foundation of skills, they're athletic, so they've done a number of different things, and who is passionate about tennis when they're 17, 18, then you got something going for you. You could have all the talent in the world, and we've seen it, but if you don't have the passion, the desire to be getting better every single day, then you're going to get passed. those opportunities are going to leave you. So to me, I would prefer, and I've said this in hockey circles too, give me an athlete for 8 months who's passionate, who's motivated, who wants to be there versus 12 and who's going at 50, 60%. You're going to get more quality work done. Now, I understand, and I'm not really an expert on sort of the U.S. tennis tournament system and how that all works, but I know it's real difficult to set up an environment where we provide fair opportunities to, you know, to work your way up the rankings and then keep it in check. There's smarter people than I that are going to have to figure that out in terms of the tennis world. So, but I do think you're right. It's going to be really difficult to create a system that can do both. And I honestly, you know, a lot of the other individual sports struggle with the same thing. So it's not just tennis.
Right. Well, I mean, I know you do a lot of work with USTA. As a parent, I would love to see them kind of glom onto this idea that there needs to be some sort of built-in mechanism in the competition structure where a child can take a month off or 2 months off and not be penalized for the remainder of that year for having done so. And I don't even come close to pretending to understand how the structure works, and I've studied it and lived it for the last 7 years. It's terribly complicated and getting more so with the proposed changes that are being considered right now. But I mean, it seems to me that if we want kids to stick around through the sport, through their junior years, into the collegiate years, and beyond, you know, and make a living at playing tennis, that we've got to do a better job at providing opportunities for them to take a step away and regroup, re-energize, rekindle that passion so they can come back with the intensity necessary to keep moving forward.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I think every stakeholder in this deal has to take a look at how they're doing things and see if they can do them better. The parents, the USTA, which I know that they're doing, the athletes, the coaches, we all, you know, sports psychology professionals, the trainers, we all play a role in this. And I think the more we can sort of get our heads together and figure out what's best, like I said, I don't have the answer to that. I know USTA has a very difficult job of figuring out what to do, what's best, because there's all these different agendas that people have that they would like to see the tennis system be for their own reasons. And so I think the key is, you know, what is going to be best for the holistic development of the child while balancing that with trying to develop elite tennis players. Where that is, I'm not sure. But as long as we're thinking about that, as we either redevelop the system or fine-tune it or whatever is happening, that needs to be a part of the conversation. And knowing some of the people I know at USTA, and I work with player development, so mostly, that they're thinking about these things. They're asking these questions. They're making decisions based on information. So that's the good news. The bad news is they got a really difficult thing in front of them on how to do this best, and, you know, there's really good people working on it. So, you know, and it's good to hear that they're reaching out and asking folks in the community as well. So,
right, and I'm so relieved to hear you say that these issues are part of the conversation that's happening at USTA right now, because I think it's crucial, and I think that, you know, for the good of our kids, as we look to develop more champion level players, we have to take these factors into account and provide downtime for them that doesn't jeopardize their ability to achieve the highest level that they are looking to achieve. So I'm very relieved to hear that you're talking to USTA, that there are others out there that are like-minded and putting this information out there. We are down to our last few seconds. So before we go off the air, Larry, I wanted to just give you an opportunity to Plug your website real quick. It is?
Sure. Our Michigan State website is youthsports.msu.edu, and you'll find a bunch of resources for parents and athletes and coaches on there. You can go to my website, tennismentaledge.blogspot.com, if you want to get a lot of tennis resources. So there's a couple of resources out there for the folks listening.
And those links are definitely on the Parenting Aces site as well. So if you didn't have a chance to jot them down, just go on our links tab and you'll find them. Larry, thank you again so much. I've learned a ton and am going to commit to being a better tennis parent moving forward. I recommit every day. Some days are better than others, but by talking with you, it reinforces the idea that it's worth the effort and really very necessary as a parent to stay focused on what's really important here, which is helping my kid be the best person he can be, not necessarily the best tennis player only, but that there are a lot of other facets to him that need to be developed along with his tennis skills. And so I thank you for that. Those of you who tuned in today, thank you for being here. If you'd like to share the link to the archived version of the show, it will be posted on our website later today and also on our Facebook page. And next week, I look forward to having you guys back. We have an exciting guest. Check our website for that information. Have a great week, and Larry, thank you again.
Thank you very much.